This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. In the apartheid-era South Africa of the late 70s, one of Johannesburg's most celebrated police captains became the country's most notorious criminal. Detective Andre Stander was troubled by his experiences serving on riot control squads confronting black student protests, and he eventually started robbing banks, even while serving on the force. Once caught, he broke out of prison with two associates in 1983 and spent several months robbing more banks, changing disguises, embarrassing the police, and becoming a folk legend. Andre Stander's exploits are the subject of a new film by my guest, director Bronwyn Hughes. She got her start working with the offbeat Canadian comedy troupe, Kids in the Hall. She directed the children's film Harriet the Spy and was noticed by Steven Spielberg, who invited her to do a film for DreamWorks. That was Forces of Nature, starring Sandra Bullock and Ben Affleck. In Stander, the title role is played by Thomas Jane. Here he is in a scene which takes place in a bank he's just robbed in minimal disguise. He's with his police colleagues investigating his own crime, interviewing the teller.
I know. It's been a bad day. You okay now?
I'm sure, miss. I've been through this over and over. But could you tell me exactly what she saw?
You.
Me.
I mean, I don't know what I mean. It's just, he was, you know, like you.
Want to take me in, Captain?
I asked director Bronwyn Hughes what she learned about what led Andre Stander astray.
Well, there are many conflicting opinions about it, because what people would know about him, they would have read in the press. And the press, of course, was owned by the government of South Africa at that time. And anything they could have read in the papers was not at all interested in a balanced or never mind sympathetic portrait of the man. So there are some people who, argue that he was just pure greedy. And however, I've been in South Africa meeting every single person who knew the man, first-hand accounts of him at that time, or people he served with on the police force, and best friends, and his wife's hairdresser, everybody we could, you know, find. And really, he was a very complicated person. So there were several things that fed him, but I know from his discussions in the late nights in prison with Alan Hale, as well as his defense on the stand, that the time he spent on the riot squad in Tembisa, which is the northeast township of Johannesburg, where in the name of duty, they were essentially demanded to commit murder, you know, so they were firing live ammunition at unarmed student protesters. And this, in the film, it's crystallized into a single dramatic sequence, but in fact, this time went on for months and months and years for some people. That period was made him such a shell of a man that he never quite got over it. And as Alan Hale put it, he said the penny dropped for Andre during that time. So his defense on the witness stand was that although I'm here on trial for robbing banks, I've killed unarmed people. And nobody seemed interested in that.
Give us one of his more colorful heists.
Well, at a certain point, they found out that a task force had been established to catch them because they'd been at it for so long. And when Andre, this is Alan Hale, the only surviving member of the Stander gang who's still in prison in South Africa and my very, very best contact for all of these stories. But he told me that they were reading the newspaper about the task force and saw a photo of the building. And Andre leaned into the photo and he said, I know this building. And right next door was, in fact, a bank which they decided to rob. So they robbed a bank in the same building as their very own task force.
And got away with it?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
There's some suggestion in the film, which you've made, that he at least some of the money he took went to the poor. I mean, I think the first job he drops a packet of bills on a black kid selling newspapers on the street. Is there any evidence that he was sort of a Robin Hood character?
Well, in fact, some people thought that that's the film they were in for. But we don't really have that sense. And in fact, if you watch Thomas's performance, Thomas Jane, who's playing Andre Stander in the film, his performance in that is more or less to discard of this filthy money that has come of this radical thing he's just done. It's not so much that he seeks out a needy person and lays it on the young newspaper boy in an act of grand charity, nor does he give it away after that moment. He spends it. It's not so much, I don't believe he was a pro-black person, or I don't believe that his upset was really about the inequality so much as the idea that he himself would be demanded something so outrageous, so, something so compromising to his own moral barometer, his own moral sense, that and he would have no say in the matter. It was, I think it really began in that ego place, less than I shall right the wrongs of the haves and have-nots, you know. So it's not a Robin Hood story so much.
I read of a couple of Associated Press accounts of Andre Stander that were written in the 80s, and they seem to indicate that he was just a bank robber, that he lived a very flamboyant lifestyle, but that his father said that he was motivated by the pain he'd experienced as a riot cop in black townships.
Well, like I said, that would be an evidence of the press owned by the government who was made to look bad by all of his exploits. So I would consider that one of the classically slanted reports, although at the same time, I'm not saying the man was a saint at all. He enjoyed spending the money, finally, and I do believe he was driven in the later years by the infamy, the fame, and the idea that he could live a lifestyle that, as a hard-working cop in South Africa, he wouldn't even come close to. So, I mean, his ego was very much a part of it. However, I do think the father has grounds in what he said based on what Alan Hale has told me in their long discussions.
Alan Hale being the surviving member of the gang, right? Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. The only one of the Stander gang still alive. And actually, it was a coup for me to find that Alan was still there. In all these years of people trying to tell the story, no one had gone to speak to him.
Why do you think he spoke to you?
Well, he didn't want to speak to me. In the first place, you know, I had to kind of work my way into the prison by less than overt means. The doors of the prison system in South Africa don't fly open to you when you announce that Hollywood is calling. You know, it's like you will be shut out before they'd be letting you in, you know. But I managed to meet him as a sort of, you know, legal consultation, sort of legitimate, you know, that's the kind of meeting that you can have. And he was reluctant because everything that had ever been written about him talked about what a thug he was, what a brute, how they were just greedy and violent, and yet there was nothing known about his political leanings and the fact that he has 2 degrees and the fact that his disgust with the system that was, what he told me once was that as a student of the teacher college, he was taught every day that he was the chosen people, and it didn't sit well with him to the point where he wouldn't go anymore. And
this is Alan Hale you're talking about, not Stander,
yes.
But Alan Hale.
No, not Stander. This is Alan. Alan finally sensed, I guess, the sincerity of my questions and the fact that I'd done enough firsthand research to not be believing the things I'd read in the press, and he started to open up to me. And he recounted for me everything that a director or a performer trying to, you know, embody these characters would need to know in so, so many ways. How they did it, what they said while they were doing it, what the bank teller said to them while they were being robbed, the political thinking behind it, the adrenaline pump, the sheer rush of robbing banks five in a row and getting away with it, and then the wave of abject fear that came over them at the end of a day when it hits you what you've really done, as well as the sinking feeling, the sort of hollowness that comes when you realize you've crossed a line and there's no turning back and your life can only be on a downward spiral. And all of these things, you know, were in both of them, I think, through the years of robbing banks. So, you know, he was really in the mode of confession when I met him.
It seemed credible, yeah.
Yeah.
Were they a violent group?
Their mission was to rob banks invisibly, or at least their style, their MO was to go in and out of a bank and rob it before anybody even realized there'd been a robbery. In fact, on occasions there would be the guard holding the door for them on the way out, thank you very much, gentlemen, which we have in the film once or twice. So, you know, they have loaded weapons, that makes it a violent crime, but their goal was not to hurt people, was not to shoot people, really that was their interest. It did, however, start to go wrong. A woman was shot in a gun shop robbery, which is in the film, actually. And at that moment, they lost a lot of popular support and never quite recovered.
In the case of the woman, she pulled a weapon on them, right? And they fired in self-defense, so to speak?
Well, self-defense, you know, they had loaded weapons out. But yes, she pulled the gun from under the counter, which is a gun shop, you know, so inevitably there'll be guns. She was shot in the shoulder, and the quote when she was interviewed, she said something like, "Andre Stander has very nice legs."
No, really?
Clearly
after
a
she
charmer.
Was shot? After she
yeah.
was shot?
There was an interview with her. "What do you remember about Andre Stander, ma'am?" "I remember he has very nice legs." So, you know, he was a charmer.
There was a third character in the Standard Gang who ultimately was killed in a shootout with police, I gather. Was he the one involved in the shootout with the woman?
Yeah, Lee McCall was the loose cannon of the three. Lee had not meant to stick around with the gang after the escape from prison. He was kind of necessary to them in that in the escape, they would have never have let Stander and Hale go off the prison site together because they were always, you know, they were hanging around and they would have suspected something. So they needed someone unsuspectable, like Lee McCall, if that's a word, to complete the escape, which he did. And the idea was they would all go, or he would go his separate way after the escape. However, he was such a lost dog, like a loyal dog sort of thing, that he never sort of disappeared. And I don't know if they felt sorry for him or what, but he just kept hanging around and ended up with them, you know, game for anything that they could invent, any kind of ante they could up, and ended up robbing banks with them all along. But he would constantly do things that would jeopardize them, like wear loud and flashy clothes that were not exactly invisible in a bank robbery. You know, this is with his rash behavior, certain things started to go wrong, which put an end to the spree, really.
You said you spoke to many people who knew Andre Stander firsthand. Just give us a little bit of a sense of what some of them said to you about him.
The funny thing about researching with people who say they know Andre Stander was that every person I met described someone radically different. So I would talk to someone who was on the drug squad with him, and they would talk about how he could, you know, he could become a hippie. And then the next person I would meet would describe how he was such a sophisticated host and had the best wine collection of anyone in the whole South African police force. And then the next person I'd met would talk about how he used to go whoring in Swaziland, you know. And there's funny stories like the rugby team from South Africa was staying in a hotel in Durban, and he went to this hotel where they were all in the bar with some lovely ladies, and he asked the star player of the team to borrow his jacket, and he put on this guy's jacket, which of course has his name on it, and convinced some girl in the bar that he was that star player and got laid. So I'm not a saint by any means, but the point was that everybody described a character that was not the same loving husband of the last description. And I thought, oh, well, these people are either all lying or there's something going on here. And ultimately, I realized that Andre Stander was all of those things. And that was the key to his character, and our characterization is what we aimed for, the ultimate chameleon. He could be whoever he needed to be in any given situation.
Well, Bronwyn Hughes, one of the most remarkable scenes in this movie, and a pivotal one, is the confrontation between South African police and angry protesters in Tembisa. Tell us about staging that scene.
Well, the Tembisa riot scene was, from the first time I read the script, the most daunting and also delicious prospect for a filmmaker in the entire script. There was an enormous weight on it, creative weight, in that if you didn't feel anything for Andre Stander in that moment, in that time, you wouldn't care what he did for the rest of the 2 hours of the film. Second of all, production-wise, it was enormous. We had production meetings that treated it like a film within a film, really. They don't have movie dogs in South Africa. They have attack dogs. So if we're staging a dog attack, you know, there isn't the kind of guarantee that you normally have that everything will go right. And one of the amazing things about the scene was that we were asking these people, 1,300 South Africans, to reenact their very recent, very emotional, and very raw and painful history on one side of the line or the other, either the township people, the black people on the crew, or the township people who I was interviewing to gather their stories and gather their experiences, or even the white kids that had been on their mandatory military service, like a pimply-faced teenager holding a gun and not really knowing what to do with himself faced by a mob like that, you know. So we were saying, okay, now do this for the movie camera. And, you know, there were security concerns. Would it go off? Would the emotions take over? In fact, the fear of that was unfounded. This was the most committed, most energetic, most realistic group of extras I've ever worked with. It was amazing. And the emotional swell of reenacting the Toy Toys where they do the protest songs had the crew with wet eyes. It was just like nothing I've ever experienced.
The actual clash, the violent clash between the protesters and the police, is preceded by this period of awkward tension at which they actually look into each other's eyes and try and figure out what's going to happen, how they should react. I thought that was an interesting approach to sort of prolong that period.
Oh, good. Well, One thing I decided from the very beginning with this riot scene was I didn't want to make it a montage of generic chaos. There are some very good films that have riot scenes in them. But I've always found that you couldn't really connect with the human experience of them because you just saw destruction and you kind of grow numb to it. So one thing that happened was that with this researcher's finds, this footage, old film footage, some video footage from the 80s that has not been seen by most South Africans because it would have never been on TV. Clips of it now can be seen in the Apartheid Museum, but that's the most, I think, that's been out there. I would get to watch the raw footage of the events. I would get to see the event unfold and disintegrate and feel the rhythms of what that was. And the thing that I was most struck by is that the tension for me was in the moments when neither side knew what the other was going to do. As the years went by, certain patterns started to be expected, the way the confrontation would begin and how they would disintegrate. But in these early years, when the film takes place, there was no real system. There was no real idea on what might happen. And I think most of the young students wouldn't have even suspected that they were, you know, going to be faced with something, with live rounds of ammunition, for example. So when these videotapes had the pauses between watershed events, like the first stone thrown or the dog first launched or the first sniper bullet, that's when I felt, oh my God, my heart rate was pumping, not knowing what was going to happen next. And I thought if we can capture anything like that, we would have something very visceral.
I think one of the things that I found compelling was this: after he has this shattering experience doing riot control work, his wife comes upon him standing naked with stereo headphones on in his house, dancing wildly to music. We see a guy kind of coming unhinged, don't we?
Yeah, that was, you know, when you dramatize something like that, of course it's a longish process, but you have to find these clues, these ways into seeing what he's going through, his emotional state. And the idea that he would be just naked and thrashing about in the living room as if trying to forget the world seemed to be a good way to do that. And that's exactly what his wife comes across, and she's much more together than him at that time in the story. And that was Thomas throwing himself body and soul into the role. I can't tell you what an actor he is to do things like that.
You mentioned that you interviewed Alan Hale, the last surviving member of the Stander Gang. You interviewed him in prison. What is his fate?
Well, Alan is serving a 33-year sentence in Krugersdorp prison outside Johannesburg. And really, in meeting him, I was very, very impressed. I thought I was going to meet a thug, which is what I'd read about, you know, in the media. But he turned out to be a very deep-thinking man who spent the last 20 years in prison in self-examination, basically trying to come to terms with the angry young man he once was and come out the other side. I don't know how you survive, so far, 2 decades of lockup at 2 in the afternoon, only to be opened at 7 a.m. with no books allowed to be brought in, no films, no movies, no television. They are allowed so few privileges there, and yet he is still so dignified, I guess is the best word. His advisors and his psychologists all recommend his release, but somehow with violent crime being such a problem in South Africa right now, they can't really see fit to release him on parole, which is due by now.
Well, Bronwyn Hughes, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Director Bronwyn Hughes. Her new film is called Stander.